Hello, friends. Let me welcome you to HAL Radio.
Let's visit the world-famous Apollo Theater and talk with Mr. Apollo Billy Mitchell. He will tell the history of the Apollo Theater to Winona Ratledge, Patricia Henry, and Linda Amsall.
Welcome to New York Chat, where we'll be chatting about all things New York. You're listening to
Linda,
Patricia,
and Winona. Today we're chatting with Billy Mitchell, the ambassador of the Apollo Theater, located in the heart of Harlem in New York City. Hi, Billy.
Hi, darling. It's a pleasure to be here. Actually, I have three titles. I am the director of tours, I am the in-house historian, and the Apollo Theater ambassador. Those are my official titles.
Okay. So they call you Mr. Apollo. Why do they call you that?
Well, because of my love for the theater, my passion, and that I've been here longer than everybody. I started running errands here in 1965, and now I'm part of a wonderful team that runs the Apollo. So the people in the community started calling me Mr. Apollo, and then before you know it, the media picked it up, and before you know it, everybody's calling me Mr. Apollo. And then 5 years ago, I wrote a book, and the title of the book is
Yes.
They Call Me Mr. Apollo.
Yes.
How did that book do? How did your book do?
The book is doing very, very well. But I have a certain way to promote it. I sell it here at the Apollo Theater, and I sell it online. But if you buy it here at the Apollo, I autograph it for people. I usually take a photo with them.
Oh, that's nice.
And a lot of my fees goes to my mentoring program. I'm a part of a group of brothers here in Harlem. We mentor children.
And what do you do? Can you tell us?
We teach them basketball. We teach them hygiene, self-respect, staying away from guns, education. You know, we take them to theaters. As a matter of fact, May 23rd, we take them to the NBA Hall of Fame.
Okay. Oh, nice.
And are these Springfield, kids in this neighborhood?
They're from Harlem.
What ages?
Ages 12 to 17. It was a place like that for us when I was a little kid living in Mount Vernon.
Was that the Boys Club?
Yeah. We had the Boys Club or the streets.
Oh.
And we had these wonderful mentors that ran the Boys Club.
Yeah.
Billy Thomas, black brother, and a white brother by the name of Pat McIver. Mm-hmm. And they made such a profound effect on myself, Denzel, and thousands
of other boys.
Thousands mm-hmm. of young brothers. You know, we played football. We ran track. Education. We did recreation. And one of the cool things that they did that really inspired all of us about education, when you went away to college, around the ceiling of the Boys Club, it had your name, the college you went to, and the year.
Everybody wanted to see their name up there.
And their school banner, the little small school banner.
It
was so impressive. So everybody wanted to go to college. For nothing else, just to have their name up there. But they told us.
The motive was good. Then.
And it was this in the 60s. When I first, Denzel was about maybe 10 years old. You know,
and how old were you?
I was 14. You know, I'm a little older. But I was one of the first summer camp youth counselors that took Denzel and them to see the Mets. When the Mets just opened up in 64. And we took them to see the Mets. And we remained friends over the years. And then, just been so proud. You just never know how life's going to turn for somebody.
Right.
You know, you remember them as a kid. And then you see what they've become.
Right.
And I am just so very, very, for the record, very proud of Denzel.
Right. Has he come here since?
Oh, yeah. Denzel's done hosted shows for us here at the Apollo. You know, whenever we can, we hang out. You know, the Apollo Theater has been a source of inspiration for me because I'm one of 14 children, you know. And how I got to the Apollo, we had been evicted from our place in Mount Vernon because we were constantly being evicted. That's why me and my brothers were taken away and placed in the foster care.
Wow.
I was 8 years old, taken out of my classroom. My brother was taken out of his classroom, another brother taken out of his class. I didn't see my sisters again until I was 12 years old. And my mom got us back together. And we thought we were going to move back to Mount Vernon, but the building we were going to move into, they were getting ready to demolish it. So we couldn't move there. So my dad came by for a minute and found us a place in the South Bronx. And it was one day while living in the South Bronx, we didn't have any food in the house. We were struggling. We moved into a building that wasn't even habitable for people. The toilets weren't working. The sink had plaster. There were holes in there. But we couldn't go back to Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
So we moved in there, and we went through some cold winters. But luckily, one of the good things about that, it was a house. We had normally lived in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
This was a house. And the boiler worked, right? Yeah. So we were kind of warm, you know. But we, at times, we didn't have any food. And I remember one day, my mom asked me to come down here to Harlem to borrow some money from a relative because we didn't have any food in the house. I think my mom had 10 kids at the time, no food. So,
were you the oldest?
No. My two older brothers and two older sisters had left to live there. Two older brothers and sisters had left to live their adult lives. My other sisters went with my dad because my mom and dad split up after we were put in the foster care. They broke up. So he took some of the girls, and me and the boys went into foster care.
Like how many boys and how many girls?
Eventually. My mother had 8 boys and 6 girls.
Wow.
Yeah, 8 boys and 6 girls. So when I came down here to borrow this money from my relative, she just happened to live across the street from the Apollo.
What?
And it's a schoolyard now. But years ago, it was a row of buildings, right? And when I went to get the money from her, she wasn't home. And I said, oh, snap, I can't go home without no money. There's no food now. Everybody's hungry. I'm hungry, you know. So to waste time until my aunt got home, I walked up and down 126th Street, you know, back mm-hmm. to the Apollo.
Yeah.
Like 3.5 hours. And it was the sun was on that side of the street. And I was hot. I was thirsty. I was hungry. I was tired. So I crossed to this side of the street where the shade was.
Mm.
And I was standing outside the door. And Mr. Frank Schiffman, who owned the theater at the time, he comes out, sees me stand there. And he says, hey, kid, what are you doing back here? I said, I'm not doing anything, mister. I'm just waiting for my aunt to come home. Well, why are you waiting? You want to make some money? He says, I'm asking you, do you want to make some money by going to the store for people? There are people inside rehearsing. He pointed to the theater. He said, there are people inside rehearsing for a show, and they're going to need somebody to go get their coffee, their food, their shoes shined, their clothes mm-hmm. pressed. And if you run these errands for them, they'll give you a little tip. I didn't even
at
know where
time,
I was going.
At that time, was it called the Apollo at that
yeah.
time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. This place has been called the Apollo ever since 1934. This building was built in 1914,
yes,
but it was called Hertig and Siemens New Burlesque Theater. But the deal is, this theater was built in 1914 as an all-white burlesque house. Blacks were not allowed to come inside this theater at all back then. And that's
ironic.
Largely because Harlem was a different Harlem.
Harlem, yeah.
See, everybody, mm-hmm. You know, the way we think and the way we've been told is always black. Harlem was originally all Irish on the west side.
Okay.
All Italian and Latino on the east side, where the Apollo Theater is, and as far as your eye can see in any direction, this whole area was Dutch and Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
The word Harlem is Dutch. There's a city in the Netherlands called Harlem, spelled H-A-A-R-L-E-M.
Yep.
We have a street a few blocks away from here called Amsterdam Avenue.
Right.
That's Dutch. Yep. New York City was originally called New Amsterdam in 1655. 1655. See, you know, these are things. And when you consider nowadays why the Apollo is so important to so many people, because Harlem is changing. History can be very, very, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
History can be distorted. It can be altered.
Yeah.
And it can be erased right in front of your face.
It must never be forgotten.
That is why I created the Apollo Theater Tours. So that whatever happens to Harlem,
right,
the accomplishments made by African Americans in this theater and in this community is never, ever forgotten. That's why I want people to come.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're going back with a different outlook.
Yeah.
These people are coming to Harlem right now, all these tours, because of what we've done and the Harlem that we made,
yeah,
jazz, literature, theater, black folks.
Did you ever think of, because I do think the tour, we would agree, the tour sounds like a great idea. Did you ever think about maybe trying to reach out to certain schools, to the drama departments and things like that you even do the tour?
Do you know how many people come here a year doing my tours? I'm the number one tourist spot in New York City. I've been given awards for it. We get people from
but all like for students.
We have school tours. Okay. My one historic tour now has school tours. We have little pre-K.
Oh, wow.
We have different types, different theme tours. Okay. It started with one tour that I started. Now for my one tour, we have an education department at the Apollo. And we have different theme tours. We have tours for the study that kids are studying the Harlem Renaissance. Or a tour for the kids that are studying dance. I've been here every day. Well, they opened up in 84, and I was working part-time here, right? Ushers, whenever there was a show, we had to beg people to come see Amsterdam. Because they hadn't seen it since 77. Mm-hmm. So it was a whole new generation. We had to bring the hip-hop generation. We had to let them know the history of theater. Come on back to the Apollo, you know? Mm-hmm. And before you know, we got the short mink jacket guys with the uptown, shoes. Okay. And it took us months. Clarence Gaston, Doug Spencer, myself, we were ushers then. And we would have to go around the community giving out free tickets to have people come to amateur. Oh, wow. And before you know it, this became the place to be. Thanks to Hal Jackson, mm-hmm. Percy Sutton, and these investors, you know. And we started doing amateur night, and then concerts started coming. And then, but people still didn't know the history of this place. And then Mrs. Sutton gave up ownership of the theater in 91. Gave up ownership, losing money. Gave up ownership, and the state then took it over because it was a landmark. And the state had this organization formed, the nonprofit organization called the Apollo Theater Foundation. All of us that worked for Percy Sutton, we were let go. Everybody. Mm. The new people brought in a whole new crew. How I got back in here in 92 is this guy wanted me to help him produce a children's show. So I came in, and then Percy Sutton, LIB, was doing Caribbean Amateur Night. So they asked me to help put that together. They decided to do the Caribbean Music Awards, the first one ever. So they tapped me to help me come and be associate producer of that. So the new people said, who's this dude? You know, he knows this place, boom, boom, boom. And I kept saying, well, I'm Billy Mitchell. I've been trying to reach you. I would like a job back, any job, you know? Mm-hmm. And they said, we have nothing, right? And I said, okay, fine. Because at the time, I was collecting unemployment. I was doing extra work in movies. Mm-hmm. And a lady that was the controller for Mr. Sutton, her name was Mary Flowers, she started producing concerts. And she had me handle the hospitality, catering, the dress rooms, make sure. So I was here a lot, you know. And then the new people from the Apollo, they finally called me back and said that we need somebody to do group sales. And I turned it down because I was making a few dollars, you know. And then about 3 weeks later, they called me again. I said, fool, you ain't got no real full-time job. Mm-hmm. So I accepted. I came back in 92 doing group sales. And then as I was doing group sales, this thing came over. I said, man, these people don't know this history. The people mm-hmm. run it don't know it. And that's when I started doing the tours.
It's beautiful.
Yes.
I get people here from France, Japan, Germany, Italy, Australia, Belgium, who have asked me, excuse me, do white people ever come into the Apollo?
Exactly.
Yeah, they always have. You know, because we Harlem is this, to a lot of people in the media, for years have been this dangerous place for white people.
Exactly.
Don't go up there. They're going to rob you.
Mm-hmm.
They don't realize what happened was back in the 60s when we were rioting. It was because Malcolm was killed. Martin Luther King was killed.
Right.
The Kennedy brothers were killed. They was doing the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
We were pissed at our situation.
Exactly.
Not at white people per se,
right.
But that is the attitude that was put out there.
Right.
And it left this stigma and this stereotypical image of Harlem on everybody's minds for years. Then in the 1980s, they said, we're going to redevelop Harlem. People started thinking that was just talk. We're going to redevelop Harlem. Harlem is going to be changing. And then before you could snap your finger, these realtors started coming up here and they started buying up all
everything.
The property.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to see for the Apollo in the future when you're not here, when we're not here?
Well, once I'm out of here, I'm out of here. You know, but the Apollo's going to be in good hands because there are some big plans, man. We have a wonderful board of directors headed by the great Dick Parsons, who used to run Time Warner, Citigroup. He's now the president of the Clippers, you know, basketball.
Oh, yeah,
that
yeah,
guy
yeah.
got fired.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But Dick Parsons, Percy Sutton, Hal Jackson, these are my heroes that I want to make sure that their legacy
lives
and
on.
What they've done lives on.
Yeah.
Because I'm telling we wouldn't be sitting here right now, mm-hmm. had it not been her dad and Percy Sutton. And even though the management here realizes that, because before each amateur night show, there is a clip about Percy Sutton and the people who started this place. Because remember, as I was saying before, the theater closed in 1977.
When you met Miss Jane Jackson, right?
Jane Jackson, it's my
one
girl.
And only.
Let me tell you what, this lady started so many careers of people that use music and you and I listen to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
D'Angelo, she
wow.
brought here.
Yes, she told me.
Yes, indeed. Comedian Jamie, Dave Chappelle.
Dave Chappelle.
Drew Hill. They were called 14 Carat. See, Jane Harley, she knows how to mold people that have a little bit of talent. And show them how to present that talent on the stage and to teach them how to respect their craft and this business of show.
Right.
But Hal Jackson, when he come in, you know, he always had the boxy, you know, he was the first black radio news broadcaster, sports broadcaster, and had his own radio show.
So before Stephen A. Smith.
Oh, yeah. I like that. Before everybody, it was Hal Jackson. I remember a little boy living in Mount Vernon, and I remember Hal Jackson used to have... Hal Jackson's at this amusement park.
Palisades
Amusement Park in New Jersey. That's all you heard on the radio. Hal Jackson reporting live from the Palisades, or at the Palisades is going to be with Hal Jackson. I'm a little boy. I'm 65 years old now. I just turned 65. I was a little boy living in Mount Vernon, about 10, 12 years old, hearing about her dad. And then one day, the man became one of my closest friends and mentors.
So now that you look back at that little boy, mm-hmm. 10 years old, listening to Mr. Hal Jackson on the radio, mm-hmm. and going through the struggles that he did at that time.
Yeah.
What would you say to him?
Thank you. Thank you, Hal. You know, I always get emotional because I remember when my daughter, my wife was pregnant with my daughter, and Hal wanted to be her godfather. But my close friend, you know, my real, you know, close friend, I couldn't tell. But that's how Hal was to me, you know.
He had two.
I don't know those things. You know, I figure one godfather, one godmother,
yeah.
you know. I'll never forget him. I'll never forget the voice. Hal had a certain distinct voice that nobody else had. And you knew when you heard Hal Jackson.
It was Hal Jackson.
Friends of everybody. You know, you name him, he's had him on his show. Everybody, and you're talking about from the Temptations to the Supremes to Michael Jackson,
right.
you know, Luther Vandross, Barry White, you name
all
them.
The greats, yeah,
all the greats. It was on the
and all
show.
And all of them were here.
Every last one was here. Mm-hmm. Every last one performed here, except Whitney Houston.
Really.
Whitney Houston never performed the
Wasn't
Apollo
there
concert.
A video, though? And it looked
that
like
was
she
it.
Was in the Apollo.
There you go. That was it. That was the only
time. Wow.
Because when she died, you know, being the spokesman about the history of Apollo, all the media came and talked to me. And they says, so what's the relationship with what do you think about Whitney Houston? And I said, we miss our sister, you know. Yeah, I know she must have some wonderful shows. I said, no, Whitney Houston.
Was that bad choice? Not
our choice. Mm-hmm. It could have been her management's choice.
Right.
Because, you know, sometimes they think that, you know.
It's not their level. Yes.
I'll give them Atlantic City. I'll give them Vegas. Yeah. I'll give them some other theater. The Apollo theaters. And then as a promoter, a lot of people stop coming to the Apollo because we're so small. It's only 1,500 seats.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but go to our website. There's an event call. Wow.
What's the website address?
ApolloTheater.org. www.apollotheater.org. And theaters with a T-E-R at the end. Some people spell T-R-E. And you go in there and look at our programming and how diverse it is now. It's not just coming to see concerts anymore. There's so many different things happening in the public. We got town hall meetings. People come in and talk about issues that affect us as a people in this community. We have guest panelists. Everybody. We have Paul McCartney's just been here recently. Bruce Springsteen and E Street Band. Justin Bieber. Now, these are acts that people normally don't think play the Apollo. Taylor Swift's been here. You know, I mean, you see, people, if you don't know what we do, you think it's just a black thing.
Right.
And that's how the world perceives the Apollo, that only black acts come here. I mean, heavy metal groups, Metallica, you know, performed here.
That's crazy.
I'm telling you. Korn, the Gorillaz. But see, those shows are sponsored.
Now, right? Even though they're sponsored for some of those white acts, do you get a lot of people coming in for them? Like, people know when they come?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the thing is that Live Nation, AEG, those are people that do those shows.
Okay.
And we get new family members now. You know, and usually they are white brothers and sisters who have never been here before. And now they're coming to see these acts. And they're seeing what the Apollo's all about. And they're coming back again for amateur night, coming back in for tours. Because their whole outlook of what the Apollo's all about is gone. They see this beautiful building. It's not run down. They see our crew knows exactly what to do. We put on top-notch shows here.
I mean, when you were growing up, did you have a dream of what you wanted to do?
No. So I kind of just wanted to survive.
I hear you.
We were hungry. I had no dream. But what happened was my oldest brother was my biggest influence. I wanted to be in business.
Okay.
Because my oldest brother got into business, self-made man, always educated, and I wanted to be just like my oldest brother. When I was a little boy, I wanted to be like my brother Steve. I wanted to be articulate, because sometimes we used to kid around the house. Hello, how are you? Are you all right? You know, just kidding. You know, but we were speaking proper. And as I got older, that's the way I normally speak now. Just sometimes people think that I'm, you know, Billy's trying to act like he's right. I'm speaking English, boo.
Proper English, yeah.
For people listening, being that little boy.
Yeah.
That was starving and didn't have anything. What would be your advice to somebody who's out there in your position at that time?
I want the kids to seriously dream big. I used to have a problem in school because I was dirty. I had low self-esteem, you know, stinky. Kids used to laugh at us, me and my family, talk about us, throw rocks at us, spit on us. So, and in the classroom, if I was being taught something and I didn't understand,
you wouldn't.
I would just sit there. And when it was time to take the test, I failed. And I started running errands here at the Apollo, and one day James Brown sat me down and asked me if I did that. I thought this man had looked into my soul. He says, young blood, sit down, I want to talk to you. He says, has there ever been a time you were in? He says, I heard about your family. First told me you heard about my, because everybody talked about me. I was that little boy around there, that poor little boy, you know. Because that first when I came out, I was dirty. And then as I started making these crazy tips, I went out and bought me some new gear.
Mm-hmm.
Got my hair cut. I was bringing groceries home. Mm-hmm. They let me come here for weeks, and then weeks turned to months. And then months turned to a few years after school running. So I got to meet all the stars. And then James Brown sat me down one day. I was so scared because I thought I had done something wrong. And because James Brown don't talk to nobody. He
and
had
at
so
that
many
time,
people
he
around.
Was James Brown.
Yeah, he was the man. And he always had people around him. So, you know, everybody called him Mr. Brown. And he sat me down. He says, son, I heard about your family, and I'm so sorry to hear about that. But he says, son, there is a way for you to come up out of that. and take care of you and your family and not live the life you and your brother and sister live? I said, how? I want to know right then and there.
How old were you then at that time?
I was 15 or 16. I just got down about 16 years old. And he said, well, first of all, son, you got to start by getting yourself a good education. And I thought this man had three heads. I thought he was going to tell me something deep. Yeah. I'd have heard that speech before. And I'm saying, yes, sir. He says, no, I'm not finished. He says, has there ever been a time you were in your classroom and you were being taught something you didn't understand, so you just sat there? And I said, yeah. And he says, how many times did it happen? I said, it happens all the time. And what happens when you take your test? Mr. Brown, I failed my test. And he laid into my ass. Excuse my friends. Boy, what is wrong with you? Don't you ever sit in the classroom and be taught something and not and don't leave that class till you understand what you're being taught, because they are always going to give you a test on it. I never looked at it that way.
Right.
But let me tell you, that advice went in one ear, right out the other. About 3 months later or 2 months later, I was in the classroom. The lady was teaching something on the blackboard. And I didn't know what she was talking about. I don't know if it was math or whatever. I didn't know. So I raised my hand, excuse me, could you go over that again for me, please? And through my peripheral, I'm looking at the other kids in the class because I was so embarrassed, you know, that they're going to say, hey, you're so stupid. You don't know that with his stinky self. You know, kids can be cruel.
Cruel, yeah.
They can be cruel. And
they still are.
Yeah, oh, yes, they are. I know. And when she tried to explain to me, I still didn't understand. I said, excuse me, could you go over it again, please? You know, a little slower, you know. And finally, after about three attempts, I finally understood a little bit what she was teaching. The next day, she gave us a test on what she had taught. And for the first time in my life, I got a 100 on a test.
Oh, wow.
Let me tell you something, ladies. That was such a boost to my self-esteem. After that, if there was ever a time I didn't understand something, I raised my hand. And my grades started going up. And then one day, James Brown asked to see my report card. Scared me to death. I didn't think my grades, you know. He looks at, whoa. And he reached to his pocket and he pulled out this knot. And he started peeling off money. And every time I got my report card, he would look at it and do the same thing.
Wow.
So I got real smart. I went to the box office. I think this lady's name was Miss Harris or something. I said, because James Brown performed there all the time back then, like every 3 or 4 months. I asked for the schedule when James Brown was going to be here. So I made sure I had my report card ready. Yeah. And when I graduated from high school, I wanted to go to college to be an actor. And I didn't know about college tuitions
and
the TAP programs and Pells.
Yeah.
And Mr. Brown knew that I wanted to go to college, so he gave me some of my tuition.
Wow. What college did you go to?
Community College.
Oh, okay.
And after I went there, I paid my own tuition to the New York Institute of Credit, where I learned how to do credit analyst. So I became a banker and gave away loans. And I worked in a clothing manufacturer. And we sold clothes and stuff to stores. But I had to analyze their credit, profit and loss statement, you know. So I had to go to school for that. When I'm representing this theater, whether it's I'm in this building or I'm outside the Apollo, it's professionalism 100%. I don't play that. I don't want anybody to think that we all are always speaking slang, that we all are not articulate.
Maybe. So do you want to leave us with maybe like a funny memory or a special story that you have from being here?
You know, there's so many. People always ask me that. You know, and there's so many, and I can't think of any. Oh, Mike Tyson was the one who started taking hundreds and $50 bills and throwing them onto the stage for the amateurs that he liked. Mm. And then before you know it, the neighborhood hustlers. They would come down the aisle with their minks on and whatnot, walk to the front, throw money up on the stage. And as people, you know, they would go back, everybody would go, oh my God, look at all that money, because they were making it go like this.
Make it rain.
So it became a ritual every week that these guys, but Mike Tyson started that whole thing. And the crew would be sweeping up $100 bills, then hand them to the talent.
Wow.
Yeah, it was something. It was. It really was.
Well, Billy, it was really great talking to you.
It's been my
ass. We could have been here for hours.
I know. And I could talk about it.
we're not going to leave the Apollo yet. We must talk to Steve Jones, director of production. Steve makes it happen.
So, we're here with Steve Jones. He's in charge. Well, go ahead, and you can go ahead and introduce yourself to the
people. Hello, my name is Steve Jones. I am the director of production here at the Apollo Theater.
Great. How many years have you been with Apollo?
As of April of this year, April 1st of this year, it'd be 15 years.
Wow. That's mm-hmm. a long time. So I'm pretty sure you have a lot of stories to tell about just production and all that stuff in general, huh?
The thing about it is that I have a lot of stories to tell, but 15 years of it just happens to be the Apollo. I've had two wonderful careers before I even got to the Apollo. Mm-hmm.
So which were?
See this gentleman up on the wall, Harry yeah. Belafonte.
Yes.
I was with his tour manager for 18 years.
Wow.
Before I got to the Apollo. I also see the picture of me and Barack Obama.
Yep.
I was doing the presidency of Bill Clinton, who was a very good friend of Mr. Belafonte's. I became the production manager for the DNC. Mm-hmm. So I used to do a lot of the fundraisers for the Democratic National Committee all over the United States.
Wow, so for you know, because the word production has such a kind of a large meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say production manager, just explain to the people what you did or, you know, what your job encompassed. Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, as a production manager, your job encompasses everything that has to do with the performance on stage, from soup to nuts, meaning lights, sound, video, special effects, the crew, the number of men and women, the budget, the schedule, how many hours we're working, what's the overtime, what's the estimated day look like? Are we working 8-hour days? Because in our business, we're union workers. Mm-hmm. And after 8 hours of work on any given day, mm-hmm. it's overtime.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And overtime is at a premium,
right.
no matter what city you're in. And since I work in New York City, overtime is huge.
Right. Yeah.
You can, depending on the size of the show, you can hit 1 hour overtime and be something like $10,000-$12,000
wow.
per hour.
Wow, okay.
Because you got to take in consideration, it's not necessarily just the hourly wages of the man,
mm-hmm.
but union rules and regulations is the pension and welfare, vacation pay, and all of those things wrapped up in it. So,
wow.
you know.
I didn't even know like a union, they had parts of like entertainment as well. I didn't know.
Yes.
I just thought it was, you know, like manual labor, like, you know, docks and stuff like
yeah.
that.
These
well,
are stagehands.
Got you.
To a stagehands union. Yeah.
Got you. So did you have a background in, because you just named a lot of things, and
mm-hmm.
each of those things are different industries within themselves, the music, mm-hmm. The lights, mm-hmm. All that. So did you have a background in each of those things, or how did you even get involved in doing
well,
all those together?
I tell you, I have been blessed with a rich history of this industry.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a man way ahead of his time. Matter of fact, he was one of the first black educators in the state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of us, he had picked our careers kind of for us.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, he thought I'd be good in theater, even though I hated it. Because at the age of 11, he enrolled me in junior theater.
Wow, so you were acting?
No.
Oh.
I was always behind the scenes.
Oh, wow, okay.
Wow.
My first job at the age of 11, for 2 weeks, I hated every minute of it. I was taking these boxes of Kleenexes, taking the twisty ties, putting them on there, and making flowers.
Wow.
I did that for 2 weeks.
Wow. Pay your dues, I guess.
I went kicking and screaming every day
yeah.
to this theater summer camp.
Yeah.
Because I never really wanted to be on stage.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But even though in school you have to have, to balance out your curriculum, you do have to have an acting, a singing kind of class, which I hated, but that's just part of the deal.
Right, right, right. So at least you were familiar with it, so you can kind of relate to the actual acting.
The thing about it was is that after finishing high school in 1974 in Spokane, Washington, my brother was a wheelchair Olympic coach. And in 1974, Spokane had the World's Fair. So he told me to come on out to Spokane and see if I could get on the World's Fair crew, because you know they play a lot of people in terms of sorry about that.
No problem.
It's okay.
So I was able to get on a crew, you know, at the age of 18, being the young and being black, they put me on the midnight crew. So my job, my real first kind of professional job, was in Spokane, Washington at the World's Fair. I was working at the clock tower, and I worked from like midnight to like 7 a.m. in the morning. And my job then, and back in 1974, it's the newest and latest high technology of cassette tapes.
Wow.
My job was, because there were speakers throughout the park, and people, the park was almost open 24 hours. Certain parts of the park were shut down, but, you know, Spokane, if you know anything about the Pacific Northwest, you got all them bohemians and late night people with guitars and people, you know.
I didn't even know it was black people up there, to be honest with you. To be honest with you. So, yeah, you definitely, you know.
So, here I am at night. I got a bank of cassettes. And my job, because new technology, has cassettes, we haven't come up with the auto reverse yet.
Oh, wow.
I was the auto reverse. So, I'm sipping tapes all night long to keep music in the park.
Wow. They had it. That was an actual job.
That's a job, yeah. And got paid real good.
I bet.
And working, and I'm 18 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I'm getting like $500 a week.
And back then,
back then,
was a lot too.
Flipping cassettes.
Wow.
Wow. We need a job like that.
Yeah. We in the wrong.
Exactly. The wrong industry. The wrong industry.
Well, that brings me to my next question. So, how important do you think it is for, you know, just, I guess, students in general to actually go to school just to pursue some a career in the entertainment industry? Do you feel like it's important?
Education is the key ingredient. That's one thing people can never take away from you. I have two degrees. I have an undergrad degree from Eastern Washington University. I have a master's degree in theater arts and management and design from San Diego State University. I was the first black at either one of those schools in production. And just being in that environment and just getting the knowledge of what it takes to do what you need to do brings you full circle when it comes to actually doing it.
Doing it.
Because it's one thing to have the book knowledge,
right,
of what the books say, and it's another thing to have the practical knowledge when you throw the book out the window and you go for what you know.
Right.
But when you have both of those at your disposal, school is really all about the processing of how to use your God-given talent to process the situation and make the best out of it. My success in this business has been not because I'm this major intelligent dude. It's just from my experiences. I've traveled the world with Harry Belafonte. I got all this education. I know people come here. I mean, people come here like, you are the calmest guy. I said, folks, if the building ain't on fire and ain't nobody dying, we can fix this.
Right. Yeah.
I've been in so many, I got so many scratches and webs and cuts and stuff and bruises on my back for the 40 plus years I've been doing this stuff. I ain't get excited about nothing. Not at this point in the game. It's all about time and money. If you didn't spend the money, then you're going to have to spend it either now or then or later, because this business costs money.
Yeah, that brings us to your next question. Like, what's the, what was your most, moment where you didn't, what was it like, a moment where you didn't know how things were going to go? Like, that was kind of, it could have failed or it could have been a success in, you know, in the production industry, or
like maybe one of your worst like production experiences ever. Like, yeah, how did you resolve it?
I tell you, in 1988, in the middle of our Belafonte European tour, Mr. Belafonte fired all of his management team. Left me running everything. And at that time, that was before the Euro dollar came out. So you were dealing with French francs, Italian lira, what else was it? German marks, Austrian shillings. I had no knowledge of any of that stuff, you know? And here I am, thrown in the fire. So I called one of my good friends, J.R. Smalling, another brother who just happened to be free from working for on, from, he was the production accountant for the Rolling Stone. I said, brother, I need you here like yesterday. And he came out and he handled the business. But in that process, it really damaged me because I ended up contracting Hodgkin's disease, lymphoma.
Wow.
From just the pressure of dealing with the day-to-day operation. Now, Mr. Belafonte's tours were huge. We traveled with like 48 people.
Right.
So you had 48 hotel rooms, 48 people to feed every day. You got to get clothes washed. You got to do the shows. You got to get on the bus. You got to get on the train. You got to get on the plane. You got to get on, you know.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm mad. Because we traveled about 280 days out the year. We carried everything. We had our own doctor. We had our own.
So what was, in that period, what was the day-to-day thing, you and how did you do it? Like, because.
Yeah. That's fascinating to us because, like you said, you got 48
You just named like, seven things that you had to do that really requires a lot of planning. You
like
know?
You're one bad
how does that happen? Like, did you had to have, like, people working under you as well?
I had production assistants.
Gotcha.
I had a good crew of people. Mm-hmm. And I had a good sense of, you know, what it takes in order to get it done.
Right.
And when you're working for an artist like Harry Belafonte, who's, you know, at the top of his game,
yeah,
you have budget.
Okay.
And if you got budget, you can make things happen.
Got you.
You know,
gotcha.
I had a Diners Club card. As a matter of fact, I spent so much money that Diners Club invited me to be part of their think tank because we were spending close to, my Diners Club bill was close to $1.8 to $2 million a year. Because remember, I'm getting hotel rooms every day. Mm-hmm. I'm getting airfares on the thing, buying meals.
Yeah.
So ain't my money,
right,
but it's
right,
through the company,
right,
but it's got my name on it.
Right.
I'm the one signing off on it. Mm-hmm. So they invited me down to say, with somebody like you that's spending this kind of money, how can we reward people like yourself? Because what they were offering was stuff that I don't need another hotel room in Hawaii. I don't want a round trip to Austria.
Mm-hmm.
I want something different,
right,
stuff that I can get.
Mm-hmm.
I want somebody to come to my house and cook me dinner, you know, me and my wife.
Yeah. Right.
Great. What they call club, what they ended up calling a club chef. Chef, come to your house, make your dinner. I want a fur coat for my wife.
Wow.
I want tickets to the NBA championship game. So I was part of that group. And Diners Club became the number one card organization that had the best rewards for their people who spent over X number.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, if only.
Yeah, right.
We can do it right now. Working towards it. Because I definitely need another fur coat. Okay, so I have another question for you. So, were there any other career fields or aspirations that you had besides working in the...
The theater is so fascinating. And the rewards are so quick because, you know, if you're really working in the industry, you're doing 6 to 7 shows a week,
mm-hmm,
you know, and that's self-gratification every day because that shows over with, the next show.
Right.
you got to do this the next show. Mm. So it's always, you know.
Got you.
And you know, you go to these meetings, you sit down, you talk about it, you talk, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, you're going to do this. And then you actually get a chance to see it on paper. And then you learn from it. You're like, oh, that didn't work. We won't do that again.
So, like, how? So do you have, like, what's your creative involvement in these shows? Is it, do you actually work with, I guess, the writers and stuff like that? To, like,
no, I really work with, they tell us, you know, what it is that they want the show to look like.
Okay,
and what they
you.
Would like the show to be. And, you know, and then we can come together with a creative team of designers.
Got you, know, okay.
And we talk about, you know, what we can do, what equipment you have in-house, what stuff you're going to need to rent to help augment, you know, all the stuff that you don't have. Mm-hmm. And then
and
the director
comes
in and it happens.
Right, got you. Got you.
That's awesome. Okay, so let's make it a little bit more fun. What were your most memorable shows that you put on, like maybe your top three, if you have a top three, if you got a top five, that's even better.
Well, oh, shows, I'd say experiences, because, you know, the show was really for the people.
Mm-hmm.
My thing is, what was the experience today?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What happened through the course of the day that was special, or something that, you know, was unique for your day. And I would say probably one of the most profound events in my lifetime, which was kind of a sad occasion, was the passing of James Brown and having his body on stage here at the Apollo. It was quite the whole thing, because he died right around Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And my phone rang, and it was Reverend Al Sharpton.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Steve, we got to bring James home. We got to let the people see him."
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I'm like, okay. I said, well, you know, we can do this, but we got to get on the phone. We better have some meetings. So the next day, he was able to call the city commissioner, the city police, everybody. We met in right down in that room where they have the, and we planned the day, because we knew it was going to be thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah.
How are you going to, what you going to, 125th Street, never been shut down before.
Right.
Mm-mm.
But they shut it down.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. They put his body in a horse-drawn carriage and brought it right down 125th Street.
Wow.
We put that casket right on stage, and we opened up our doors for viewing for the next 18 hours straight.
Wow.
That's amazing, yeah.
CNN had a pool camera that kept us live all day.
Mm-hmm.
People were coming in and out, in and out, in and out. Wow. And we actually had to shut it down.
Yeah.
It's like, look.
I bet.
We've had enough.
I bet.
For the day. So, yeah.
That's amazing.
So that's one of the ones that here. Mm-hmm. Now, away from the Apollo, I would say the series, two things. The night that we did We Are the World, the night that we recorded that song.
Wow.
Oh, where?
That's Michael Jackson's song, right?
Well, Harry Belafonte, Michael Jackson, and
a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
Well, the three main people that were involved in it was Quincy Jones, who was like an uncle to me. Call him Uncle Q. Mr. Belafonte and Michael Jackson.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, what was that like, being in the studio and singing?
With all those people?
Yes, that had to be amazing.
Well, you know, Harry, the thing about Mr. Belafonte is that when Danny Kaye died, Mr. Belafonte became the ambassador for UNICEF.
Uh-huh.
He's always been, you know, this common denominator humanitarians.
Okay.
So when he speaks, out of just respect for him, you know, we said, look, guys, leave all that ego and shit at the door. They're coming here to sing this song to raise money for these kids who need help.
Mm-hmm.
So once that was said,
And the people just, so I bet it was great energy in them, because there was so many big names in there. That's why that needed to be said.
Yeah,
especially at that time too.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So like, I do have a question. So so Showtime at the Apollo, right? Mm-hmm. So how was that even put together, and was it and what was your involvement in was it any more crazy? Did it make your day to day thing any more crazy, or were you kind of was it pretty much the same?
The thing about Showtime at the Apollo, or anytime you shoot any kind of television show, for me, it's okay, but it's not exciting for me. Because it's taped entertainment. It's not live.
So it's edited.
You stop. Okay, take a break. Now fix this. Okay, now keep on going. See, for me,
so exciting on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
exciting
on TV.
That's the whole point.
That's the whole point.
When you're recording the thing, if it ain't live, you can fix it.
So that's why you like theater so much.
It's live. You make a mistake, it's it. You can't go back and fix it.
So you never really thought about like doing film or like doing film production or anything like that?
I like live.
Stuff.
I want your heart beating. I want you to be on the pulse. I want you to think, if I can't mess this up, cause once that's gone, it's gone. You don't get that back.
Right.
So it's got to be right the first time.
So are any of the shows that you do that are the same shows? That is everyone different? Is every like show?
Every show is different.
Every show is different, right?
Every show is different. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it's the same show every
night.
But Mrs. Belafonte used to say to us every night after doing the show 200 straight days. Mm. Every night is the first night. Do not rob the audience of the experience.
All right. Yeah.
Just because you heard it last night.
Yeah, just because you tired of doing it. Yeah. This,
right. Play it like you play it the first time. Because they deserve it.
For everything. That's crazy advice for everything.
I did this show yesterday. I'm going to just do a halfway today. Like, no, you have to.
That's why people came to see this man in droves. The first tour I did with him was in 1985. Now, this is a crazy story. When I was in the fifth grade, my Uncle H.J., took me to go see Mr. Belafonte. Actually, he took us to go see two concerts. The first concert he took us to go see was Earth, Wind & Fire. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the fifth grade. Uh-huh. So of course he smells herb in the audience. And the next thing I know, we're running out the building. So we didn't see much of Earth, Wind & Fire, even though it was exciting. Yeah. I mean, 'cause they had just come out with Keep Your Head to the Sky.
Oh yeah.
Hold on. Question. So Earth, Wind & Fire, did they promote that? Or
what's that?
Like you said, they smell herb. And
no, it's just audience.
Oh, okay. Oh, audience. I thought that was something that I was a fun fact.
No.
Oh, why?
Because that's one of my first real concerts that I went. Yeah.
Got you.
The second night, he took me to go see Harry Belafonte.
Got you.
So here I am at Heinz Hall with my uncle in the fifth grade watching Harry Belafonte. Now later on, when I graduated from undergrad at Eastern Washington University in 1979. My father, as a graduation present to me, takes me to the opera house to go see Harry Belafonte.
And how crazy is that?
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
Now, fast forward to 1985. Mm-hmm. I get a call from Douglas Gray, who's Harry Belafonte's production manager, asking me to come and interview with Mr. Belafonte. Because he's looking for a production lighting designer. I'm by trade United Scenic Artists.
Oh, what I said?
United Scenic Artists.
Okay.
Local 829. I was one of the four black people in United Scenic Artists as a designer, lighting designer.
Wow, okay.
So he hired me right there on the spot. And our first show was where? At the Opera House in Spokane, Washington.
Wow. Did you tell him that?
Yeah. So here I am going back kind of home. To the state of Washington for my first show with a major artist, Harry Belafonte.
That's amazing.
It's just all connected. Right?
Like I said, I have had a wonderful, wonderful career in life. And I still got a lot more left that I would love to do because I'm only 58 years old.
Yeah, you're still young.
So how did, so with you doing the, not the same thing every day, but doing it so long and experiencing a lot of different stuff, probably more than once, more than twice, how do you maintain the love and the motivation and the passion for what you do to continue to do your job the best you can?
I think what happens with people like myself is you find a career that you really enjoy working in. Mm. And it's,
right.
For me, it's the only thing that I know how to do.
Yeah.
Mm. And there's so many different parts of it and managing people and people's spirits and all of those things that every day is different.
Right.
Regardless of if you're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, because things happen.
Exactly.
And you got to motivate your crew, and this guy's having a bad day, and this guy, and then, man, come on, y'all. We got to come together as a unit to make this happen in spite of what might be happening in your home and in your house and with your children and with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you show up here at 8 o'clock or whatever time the call time is, I need you to be here.
Right.
And I need you to do your job that you are here specialized to do. You're a carpenter, come here and be the best carpenter you can be. You're an electrician, come here and be the electrician. You're the audio guy, come here and do that job. I need you body and soul to get this thing done.
Because
if you're not going to do it, then call me or replace yourself.
Right. Yeah.
Because I ain't got time to babysit nobody.
Exactly.
Right.
Because you got so many other things.
I got a job to do.
Yeah, exactly. Just like you do.
Got you. Yeah, so my self-motivation is just really, you know, seeing how well I can perform that day to get the best out of my people.
Got you. Got you. And that's another ending. Not another ending battle, but it's always something different.
Cause
you never
always.
So that's what keeps, I guess, the fire going. Just because you never know what's going to happen. Got you.
Most definitely.
Never know.
Okay, so what was the situation maybe in your adolescence or I guess in adulthood where someone told you that you couldn't do something, like they tried to like throw you off balance and then you actually achieved
it? Okay, in the situation?
Yeah.
Well, that's a black person every day.
Especially, yeah.
As a black male, you know. When I, at Eastern Washington University and at San Diego State University, there was a lot of adverse things that I had to overcome. Being one of the first blacks to graduate from either one of those schools in the theater program was hard. They didn't make it easy on you. When I showed up at San Diego State University in 1979, it's almost when I showed up they forgot that I had even been invited to come. Because they looked at me like, how'd you get in this program? I came and interviewed, and y'all told me I was in.
Yeah.
So here I am. So here I am in the graduate lab, and Dr. Don Powell, with his whatever that scarf thing around his neck, I forgot what they call it, ascot.
Yeah.
Steve Jones, you're in the graduate lab. I said, yes, I'm getting, so I'm the only one in the graduate lab. I'm trying to get this design done. Well, you know, your assistantship is in dance, which is next door. So you need to give me your keys to the grad lab over here, and any work that you're going to do, you need to do next door in dance. I'm like, well, I teach dance lighting over there as part of the theater program. But we ain't got no drafting rooms over there. It's like if I worked done.
Yeah.
That's not my problem. He says, I don't think you should be in this program anyway because you're not cut from the same cloth as everybody else.
What?
I'm like, well, I know that. I'm the only black person that you got in the damn program. You know? But I said, hey, man, no problem. Here's my key. I called my daddy. My daddy said, don't worry, son. Call me back tomorrow. And called him back the next day. My father said, go downtown San Diego, meet Mr. What's-Her-Name at this drafting store, pick out your drafting table, and they're going to deliver it to your house, to your apartment, which worked out really great because now I got a drafting machine in my apartment. I can do work all night and all day.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
But, you know, it's always been that.
Wow.
You know, you can't do this and you're... you can't use that, and you can't, and you can't, and you can't. And
wow.
You say, okay. We're going to figure it out anyway.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, because just day-to-day stuff that you that everybody else will be able to do, you couldn't do it just because you, just because of the color.
Yeah.
And I can just only imagine dealing with that today.
Yeah, because I feel like we have it a lot easier. I mean, it's still some obstacles, but, you know.
Yeah, nothing like it was in the
70s. Yeah, right, I bet.
That's
but,
crazy.
You know, but that all that does is just make you a better person.
Exactly.
That's all.
Yeah, most definitely. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as far as, like, I know we talked about, you know, you put it on the shows and stuff like that. Like, as far as the acts go, do you choose the acts?
My job is once... Just like this, James Taylor's coming here on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
They send me this production schedule. I look at the production schedule. I tell them whether it's going to work or not, if the timeline on here is going to work, and how many men we're going to need to do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really, you know, what I do.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Most definitely. Okay, so last question.
Okay.
And we're out your head.
I don't mind. I just got to get on stage at 1 o'clock.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so, well, perfect timing. Define to us what you think is a winner, whatever it may mean.
And I guess you can think of it in terms of what does it really take to do what you do? What type of character traits does it really take to do what you do and be successful at it?
I think a winner, anybody who considers themselves a winner, the only way that you can become a winner and be a true winner is that you got to know who you serve. If you serve God as your master, you're a winner every day,
because
he's going to take care of you. He's always delivering for you. And as long as you can, as long as you have a relationship with him, to go to him and say, I need your help. Can't do it on my own, because I ain't all of that. As much as everybody might think you are, as much as other people may seem to want to be.
Yeah.
Unless you have a personal relationship, I ain't trying to preach to nobody.
Yeah.
But I'm just telling you, the reason why I am who I am is because I know who I serve.
Mm-hmm.
And I know who serves me. And that's why I am Steve Jones, one of the top black production managers, or manage, not even black, one of the top production people on the planet.
Now, Hal has some fun times years ago with attorney Leon Peace Jr.
Okay, I'm Leon Peace. I am currently living in Washington, D.C. I'm a lawyer lobbyist down here and grew up in Yonkers, New York, actually, and which is what led me to come into contact with Mr. Jackson. As a kid, growing up in New York, and I listened to the radio quite a bit, and found myself, of course, you would inevitably come across a Hal Jackson radio program, and looking back now as an adult, I realized I took it for granted, because you would see a number of the so-called big stars come and go, but you felt a relationship with Mr. Jackson because he was always there. I thought, as looking back as now as an adult, I realized that, you know, we had Frankie Crocker, all these guys in the back, and they had egos that were just, you know, beyond. They didn't have any lack of self-esteem. But Mr. Jackson was someone who was almost like a family. You know that if you went to the Apollo, and we would, you know, in Yonkers, we would, during the summer, at least make 2 or 3 trips down there. As far as our youth group would go down there, and we heard a lot about talented teens, and you'd see Mr. Jackson there consistently. And it never occurred to me that the amount of work and dedication that it took on his part to consistently pl- push and promote for kids. Now that I'm trying to do some of this stuff myself, I realize, I mean, my father did a lot of this stuff, and, you know, as a kid, you say, yeah, that's the way, you know, people do. Not everybody is concerned, and I can honestly say, I can't think of anyone else in the New York City area who took that level of concern consistently for those of us who are coming up. And I don't know how many other people, how they turned out in the long run. I at that time, I became a musician, and I was playing as a, at one point with some Capitol recording artists and around New York. Some of my friends would play at the Apollo. And we went down there. Mr. Jackson was there. He'd come out, make it, and at every occasion, he would never fail to mention how important it was that we focus on children and that these are talented kids promoting, you know, the future. Again, as a kid, you take this for granted. So everyone's concerned about kids. We're supposed to be the subject of their concern. As an adult trying to do that, it is an extremely difficult task, and there are very few people who are concerned about that. So when, essentially, this is about what you want to say about Mr. Jackson, it's inspiring because at that time, those words of encouragement, even though we're out in the audience, we're just some kids from Yonkers, New York, down there in the city, all that encouragement builds up. And over a lifetime, you realize that as you become an adult, as one becomes an adult, there's a certain obligation to try to do the same thing for the other kids that are coming up behind you. And so I think it's an exciting opportunity to say thank you, though I never got a chance to say it to him personally, but to say those efforts were appreciated, not only by me, but speaking up on behalf of all the other young black kids in New York as their unaffected, unelected, and unselected representatives. I think we all want to say, I want to say thank you for having taken that time consistently, day in, day out, year in, year out, to always promote not just talented teens, but say, let's focus on young kids. Look at, you have a future. You can do what you want to do. Have your dreams and aspirations and go for it. There are so many people, there's so much negative, so many negative influences out there telling you you can't do it, you won't do it. There's God's schedule for X, Y, and Z. That was never, to my recollection, my observation, the message from Hal Jackson. As I said, we went through AM, went to AM, FM, WBLS, all the, you know, hip-hop, all of these things that somebody's doing, but that consistent message was always there. So I think that the Crawford will continue his legacy. It certainly is needed more now than back then when I was a kid, 100 years ago. So there the forces of ignorance and negative influence are manifest and are pushing people down even more. I mean, we knew we had to wear our pants up and how to wear a belt and carry ourselves to try to get there. We still had a tough time getting jobs. But now the influences are pushing in the other opposite direction. So that type of, his type of influence and message is particularly needed today. I didn't mean to take up all your time with the speech, but that's just my passing thought as I go through here. It's off the top of my head. I think that it's a great opportunity that we'll have to go forward and take that message not just from New York to throughout, but here in Washington, D.C., there's a sore need for it. I know in North Carolina, in Michigan, in Detroit, you know, the West Coast, it's a message that needs to be out there.
You are absolutely right about that. Absolutely. We definitely appreciate everything that you had to say, especially knowing that it's so very sincere.
Yeah, it's sorry. I mean, it's like, my my interest has always been in the industry and in politics. I operate at the intersection of the entertainment industry, the political, and the legislative. So that's what keeps me here in D.C. I always keep contact with New York, my home, North Carolina, where my family's from, and crossing those borders, I said there's a lot of similarity. Looking at that similarity, especially up there, on Capitol Hill, the legislators need to have accurate information from what we call outside the Beltway, that little highway that surrounds Washington, D.C.
Yes.
As to what reality is like, because here in Washington, it is sort of an artificial setup there. You know, just as an aside, there are three Washington, D.C. John Edwards ran for Congress and made history when he said there are two Americas, there are three Washington, D.C. It's what they call official Washington, which is Congress, et cetera, and the White House. There's an upper crust Washington, which is the northwest section of Washington. But then there's what they used to call the Chocolate City. And the three are rarely intersect. Let's just say the black part of the city has a better understanding of the other two parts of the city, but the other two Washingtons have no understanding at all of our part of the city.
Absolutely.
Having said that, so that message that we're talking about can be communicated to Washington through the legislators and the lawmakers once we have, we talk to kids and also we teach them how to effectively represent themselves and come to Washington to make their position known.
Absolutely. Mr. Peace, thank you so very much, sir, for your time. It can't be said any better than what you said. Absolutely.
Thank you, Hal.
And now, we will listen to some of Hal's wonderful classics.
Attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way he woos me. I don't want to leave him now. No, I believe in love. Somewhere in his smile he knows that I don't need no. Leave him now.
Hello again, friends. It's amazing how time flies. Can you believe that's the end of our show today? Well, we hope HAL Radio has brought a ray of sunshine to your day, as well as uplifted your spirits. Be sure to join us again next Monday, right here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember to make us your favorite station. Subscribe to us here, and also visit us on the website. That's www.blogtalkradio.com/HAL Radio for even more upliftingly affirmative jewels. Be sure to tell a friend or two that HAL Radio is the place for all things uplifting and positive.